Welcome to Archiverted. This week, we speak with Darian Turner, Assistant Curator of Indigenous Art of the Americas at the Baltimore Museum of Art. In our conversation, we discuss the evolution and challenges associated with collecting and presenting Native and Indigenous art in an institutional setting and the involvement of Native makers and curators in the museum. So without further ado, let's jump in. I'm so excited to have you on the podcast today. I haven't seen you since we graduated from graduate school. It's quite a treat. And you recently got appointed Assistant Curator of Indigenous Art of the Americas at the Baltimore Museum of Art. Congratulations.
Thank you. I'm so happy to be here talking with you today.
So I can't wait to talk about your current show, which I know was delayed with COVID and now kind of by happenstance is the only gallery in the museum that's open. So it's the only art you can see at the Baltimore Museum of Art. But before we get into your position and your show, I just want to start off with how you got into the arts.
So I've appreciated art since childhood. However, sadly, I was not born with an artistic bone in my body, unlike other family members. So I had to find different ways to really find art. And so I was drawn to museums early on and studied art history along with comparative literature in my undergrad and had an opportunity in my junior year to work for the museum collection at Yellowstone National Park. And I would say that was my first moment where I was really in museums, really in the art world, though a sort of remote corner of the art world. And that position was really amazing because it was such a small group of professionals working in that museum. And I had access to objects ranging from, you know, Thomas Moran paintings all the way to, you know, the skulls of wolves that had died in the park recently. So there was a huge diversity of material, and it was really interesting to spend time cataloging it. And, you know, working in the back room of the collection. And it was really through the process of cataloging postcards that I had a really profound moment with a piece of art. I was spending time, you know, just scanning them and flipping them over and reading them and transcribing what was on the back of them into a database. And I found myself really moved to tears by the message, a really short message on a postcard where a woman in the early 1900s, shortly after the park opened, was writing to her family and reflecting on the fact that she was traveling alone. And I felt such a tenderness towards this person and such a deep connection to them, even though obviously I would never meet them and I can't really imagine her experience of the park, of what it was to travel to the park in the early days. But despite that, I felt a real sense of empathy with that, the person that wrote the postcard. So I would say that that was the moment where I locked in and knew I wanted to be working at museums and fostering moments of empathy like that for other people. So then, you know, things developed. I graduated from my undergrad university, worked a little bit in museums on the development side and switched sectors, and found myself working in finance, actually, and just not being happy, not feeling fulfilled. I wasn't able to exercise empathy in that field, believe it or not. So I felt drawn to go back to school and study material culture. And yeah, eventually that led to my position today.
For those listening who don't know what the field of material culture studies are, could you enlighten us?
So I would say that it's the history of objects. So art history is paintings on the walls and sculpture, and material culture is everything in our lives. So, you know, it could be a set of headphones. That could be material culture. It could also be, you know, a Lakota beaded vest. There's a huge range of objects. I would say it includes pretty much everything. So I loved that it was a flexible field where I could pursue a lot of different inquiries and look at the lives that people led through the objects that they used in their lives.
Yeah, that was one of the things about Bard. And we had a wonderful professor, Catherine Whalen, who her definition I thought was brilliant. It said, it's the intersection between people and their things.
Yeah,
that's exactly. It's just stuff, and really.
It's just stuff, but cool stuff.
Cool stuff, like your that postcard. Stuff.
Exactly, exactly.
And I remember you studied medieval European art in college, and that was one of your great interests and focus. And I'm wondering, how did you make the jump between medieval art to indigenous Native American art?
So actually, there's more in common between medieval art and Native art than one might expect. And I think that really comes down to this appreciation of materials and materiality. So when we think about Native art, a lot of times, Native artists were pointing to the history of this material in its use. So we see in ivory works that they're pointing to the source of the ivory. They're considering the animals that were used to create this work. And there's a really strong connection vis-a-vis the material. And we also see that in medieval art, albeit in a different sense. So ivory, oftentimes was imported from very, very distant lands. And so they were recognizing the expense of that and the sort of life cycle of that elephant tusk that turned into a pen box to hold a trader's pens. So I think there's this nod to the life cycle of the materials that were used to create objects. And that's the major commonality I see. And then another thing in common is the importance of history. So a lot of times when we see these objects, we don't know the people who made them. We don't know their names. We can't, sometimes we can't even identify, you know, the exact year that they were created, but we know the context. We can look to certain clues in the way the materials were treated or how, you know, quills were applied to this quillwork case. And that gives us a window into the lives of the people that use these objects.
There's a lot of association with decorative arts as well in that, which is also your focus. So
yeah, I feel like that's your area of expertise.
It's all of our, that's what we were trained. I remember when we started grad school, they were saying that they were calling paintings flat art, wall art. And I was stupefied because that's really the only thing that I had studied in college. And I'd never heard the word materiality. And I was just kind of totally thrown off my rocker. And I was like, okay, I'm in a totally different field now.
Yeah. I think the great thing about material culture is it's so focused on the experience of the user. So whether it's, you know, the crozier that an abbess used to shepherd her flock of people that she was overseeing in the church setting. We really see, you know, the history of these people's lives in the objects that they use.
So you're a member of the Yurok Tribe of California and the first Native curator at the Baltimore Museum of Art, which is a huge deal. And I'm wondering if you could talk about your tribe and how being Native impacts your work.
Yeah, so my tribe is located in the northwest corner of California on the Klamath River. And our location meant that we actually were exposed to colonial forces relatively late in the game. So my grandfather's grandfather remembered his tribe's first encounter with white people. And wow. Actually, white people came into his camp and were murdering tribal members. And he fled by jumping into the river and swimming away and was actually shot through the leg, just clean through the calf in that experience.
Wow.
And what's crazy is that's a pretty close relation. The fact that that's just, you know, a few great grandfathers up the chain is pretty remarkable when we compare it to the rest of, or much of the rest of Native Americans who had, you know, 100 years more exposure to white culture and white aggression. So I think that my tribe is unique in that way. And it really emphasizes the way that all of the different tribes had different experiences. So my tribe had our experience, which was very different from the Seminoles' experience, which is very different from the Mohawk people's experience. And when I come to curating Native art, I want to recognize that we Native people are not a monolith. We don't have one single culture. We are a sort of kaleidoscope of all the different cultures of the Americas. And it's important to embrace that and really figure out a way to communicate that to visitors, because that's probably not the first thing that comes to mind when they hear Native American.
Yeah, absolutely. And I was so happy to here just for you that you were appointed. Now it's really exciting that museums are starting to hire Indigenous curators. And I wonder if you could talk about kind of that trend and what's happening and how it relates to this moment. And I think most visibly what I've read at least is the appointment of Patricia Marroquin Norby, the curator of Native American art at the Met.
Yeah, that's a huge step forward. I think the Metropolitan Museum of Art is sort of like the biggest museum force in the U.S. And so by hiring a Native curator, they signaled a shift in the field overall. And I think that that shift is really necessary and important. And I'm glad that it's happening. There's a level of visibility to Indigenous people, you know, just by virtue of the BIPOC movement. There is a level of visibility of Native culture that I have not experienced in my lifetime, just in this last year. And I think museums are catching on to that and embracing the fact that there is history in the United States that predates the arrival of, you know, the Mayflower. History doesn't just start with that the moment that white people set foot on this continent. And I think this is overdue. I'm really appreciative that the field is pivoting this way and creating an inclusive place where a lot of different stories can be told. So I'm excited about that hire. I'm really appreciative to my institution for recognizing that we need someone to represent these two collection areas of pre-Columbian and Native North American art. I started at the Baltimore Museum of Art as the curatorial assistant for the Arts of Africa, the Americas, Asia, and the Pacific Islands. And we're a really small department of just two full-time people and one part-time person. And the museum recognized that we need to get Native work out on view. We need to have exhibitions of it. And we need someone who can help us figure out how to navigate that. So I'm lucky to work alongside brilliant colleagues who support that and felt the need to, you know, bring Native art to the people of Baltimore.
Yeah, absolutely. And the fact that you do have a large collection of Native art, could you talk about the collection and the history of that and how it's been presented?
So we have about a little over 1,000 works of art from Native North America. And we started building our collection in the 1940s, way before we had curators specializing in that material. And over the decades, we had one curator who represented that collection and our Oceanic collection, who had a background in anthropology. And then she ended up leaving the institution, and we had a person that worked on our Ancient Americas collection or pre-Columbian for a short period as well. But there's just these big gaps where no curator was dedicated to this material. There were a few big shows that happened in the early 90s. There was one on beadwork, and there was another show on Inuit wall hangings that happened. But then pretty much no special exhibitions happened from that point forward that focused exclusively on Native art. There were a few things out in our permanent collection galleries, but they were situated alongside pre-Columbian works and African works, and were never really given breathing room. They were never looked at on their own merits. So I think that we're expanding the way we're thinking about Native art by now putting it into conversation with our American art. So that's something that I'm really excited to be collaborating with our American art curators at the museum, and just figuring out a way to make this history accessible to people.
Yeah, I mean, I know that when we were in school, we were fortunate to have classes at the Met, and one of them was about American art, and it was it, the what they were doing at that point was, and what a lot of institutions were doing at that point and even before, is redefining or expanding their definition of what American art is, what America is. And at that point, kind of the hot topic, or at least what they were starting to collect, was Spanish colonial art and French colonial art. And now, finally, we're going back older than that. You know, I feel like it's, you know, step yes. by step. You know, the pre-Columbian, I think, has always had, I don't know, in a lot of places, I think there's always been an understanding that that art is important and exists, but it's kind of relegated to, it doesn't really have anything to do with America, you know, in a lot of collections.
Right. It's interesting how different work is alienated from this timeline. Like, oftentimes, Native art is seen as static, as something that has never changed, that these people are from a primitive culture, and that, you know, just by virtue of being exposed to white people, they recognized that they were obsolete and, you know, just stopped producing art. And that's complete nonsense. Native people change their art over time. They look at their surroundings and they get new materials to work with. And they were interacting with white Americans and, you know, getting exposed to styles that they maybe had never seen before, or acquired materials like beads that they took to a level that white creators never really took beads. They've covered entire garments with beads. So I think that we have a lot of work to do in the field to educate people, to show them that Native art is important, that it has transformed over time, that it reflects a really complex and important history in the United States. There's more than just, you know, George Washington. And when we think about the foundation of this country.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I'm excited for the transformation of the field.
And I think part of that has to do with terminology, or at least there's differing terminology and different ways of, you know, departments are named differently. I know at the Met, it's Native American art, whereas mm-hmm. your title is Indigenous Art of the Americas. Can you talk a little bit about the different terminology and how that operates and why you use what you use and how that relates to the scholarship and the community? And
yeah, I mean, it follows a chronology. So we started off by being called Indians based on Columbus's mistake. He arrived at this continent, thought he was in India, called these people Indian, and never like corrected it. So that's where we start. Then we move forward in time and we see American Indian, and that's a really helpful term to distinguish the people of these continents from the people of India. So that was a correction. And we see that enshrined in institutions like the National Museum of American Indian, which is the Smithsonian's Native American Art Museum. And we moved, and that was opened in the early 2000s. So that's how recent the American Indian was used. As we move forward in time, later into the 2000s, we see this shift to Native American, where we drop the Indian, drop that mistake altogether, and focus on the fact that the people who were here were indigenous to this area before, you know, the Mayflower arrived. So I think Native American was a move in the right direction. And eventually Native people dropped off the American altogether and just called themselves Native. And I think that points to this history of alienation from, you know, the American government, and really embraces that we exist without the title American. And I think that Indigenous takes that one step farther. So Indigenous reflects a more inclusive term. It's a more inclusive term because it also invites people of South America and Mexico to be a part of this identity. And also, you know, Indigenous populations all over the world. It highlights the fact that people lived in a place before white people arrived, and we need to acknowledge that. And I think that Indigenous is getting even more popularity based on the BIPOC movement. So that is something that I think is very important. Like I said earlier, Indigenous people have more visibility right now than any other time in my lifetime. And I think a big part of that is BIPOC and just this interest in highlighting people of color's contributions to history and art and just, you know, American identity.
Yeah. Yeah, I couldn't agree more. It's definitely at the tip of people's tongues these days. Yeah. And how is that affecting your work? Are people now looking for, I mean, you know, I know a lot of museums are now changing their programming, their acquisition, directives to acquire more, you know, a couple of years ago, even last year, it was works of art by female artists. And now, and now it's Black artists. And I'm wondering, I'm hoping that it's Indigenous artists is not next, but it's happening now, but definitely that it's coming next. And
Yeah, and in perpetuity, hopefully. Mm-hmm,
absolutely.
So actually, the Baltimore Museum of Art was really leading the charge and calling attention to the fact that museums need to collect works by women artists. So our year 2020 was dedicated to collecting women artworks made by women. All of our acquisitions this year are works made by women. So that's something that's near and dear to our hearts. And I do think that the museum field in general is starting to recognize the important role that Native people have played in the field overall. I think we're finally getting recognition for things we've been doing for centuries. So I appreciate, you know, artists like Nicholas Gallinan and Jeffrey Gibson and Carol Romero and many, many more who call attention to the ways that our art can be both a nod to our history and this sort of imagined future that we want for Native people and just people in general. I think there's a level of recognition of that right now in museums, which is really exciting to me.
I think that's happening also in the communities. For the first time, you're seeing land acknowledgement statements. There's one your website in Dallas when on Indigenous Peoples Day this year, they announced that they were renaming the main river that comes through Dallas, the Trinity River, back to Arcacosa, which was the Caddo name. So I wouldn't say renaming, but they're returning the name or getting rid of the Western name, I guess. And so I'm really excited to see that finally happening. But the acquisition of Native art has a very complicated history, and there, especially with provenance and repatriation, and there was very famous in the field a law called NAGPRA, which is the Native American Graves Repatriation Act, that was passed in 1990. And I'm wondering if you could just explain that law and its impact on the collections of Native art, how it affected your institution and the field as a whole.
I think I want to back up, and I bet some people that are listening don't know what the word provenance means. So that just means the history that is tied up with an object. If I have full provenance, I know who made it, who they sold it to, who that person sold it to, and we have a clear chain of custody. So that's really important when we're looking at Native works, because we want to make sure that they were acquired in a way that is like A, legal, and B, respectful. So the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act, NAGPRA, was really a sea change in the field. It provided guidelines regarding repatriation, so the return of objects to their source communities, and the disposition or dispossession of certain Native American items. So federal agencies and institutions that receive federal funding are required to comply with NAGPRA. And they are required to return four different types of objects. And one of these is not an object. First and foremost, human remains don't belong in museums. They belong with their source communities. So that was one of the biggest wins that NAGPRA facilitated. It's really sad that had to happen. There was a law that had to pass to return people's remains to where they belong. Then the second type of object that falls under NAGPRA is funerary objects. So things that were placed near human remains as part of a death rite or ceremony. A third category is sacred objects that are needed for the modern day practice of traditional Native American religions. And the fourth type is cultural patrimony or group owned objects that have ongoing importance to the group. So essentially after 1990, our museum and all museums that get federal funding had to comb through our entire collection, figure out which tribes belong to which objects, and then reach out to those individual tribes saying, hey, here's a list of stuff that we have that was from your community as you were the source community. Are any of these things inappropriate for us to have? And so there was a correspondence that happened over years, and there are very detailed records that our museum and all museums keep to ensure that we have reached out to the people that need to know about these objects. And so it served a twofold purpose. One, it returned things that really need to go back to their source community. And two, it also highlighted that we have these things. And hey, if you want to come visit them, even if you don't want us to repatriate them, please come visit them. You know, we want you to be able to have access to these objects, even if they aren't necessarily legally, you know, deemed or legally determined that they need to go back to you. So I think that it did a lot of lifting for the field. And when we look at where repatriation requests are happening right now, it's not Native American art. It's, you know, the arts of Africa, the arts of the Pacific Islands, that there are big pushes right now to repatriate material from those regions. So we're lucky that we got ahead of the curve on that, and that the objects that really should be back with their home communities are already back. I think that's a unique win in the field of what used to be called the primitive arts.
Absolutely. And those four categories really encompass a lot of objects. And I'm kind of wondering, you know, what does that leave for museums to retain? It does leave a lot. It does leave a lot because your collection is pretty large. What it leaves, yeah. and even acquiring new work that isn't contemporary made work. Mm-hmm. Obviously, it's because they're passing through dealers. And so those items are already on the marketplace.
Yeah. And it's really important when you're considering an acquisition, that brings us back to provenance. You want to make sure that it is clear who owned it, when they acquired it, and that they didn't do so by like digging up a grave site, that they bought this in a way that was legal and transparent. So I think that that's something that a sensitivity that has really been embedded in the field for decades. You asked what sorts of works are not subject to NAGPRA. So one type of work that we have a lot of at our museum is basketry. We have over 300 baskets, and those are way outside of this funerary object field, the sacred object. These were beautiful objects that were made either for use or just to be beautiful. And there are plenty of different sorts of objects like that. Not everything was found in a gravesite, so there's plenty to work with in the field, luckily.
Baskets and pottery and clothes and yeah, there's a lot of objects.
Everything in between, not to mention painting.
Absolutely. But as far as those objects that weren't made to be, you know, art, because a lot of these objects, I mean, it's similar kind of to the field of African art, where there wasn't really a concept of art for art's sake. And these are objects that served a specific religious or social function. Are Native populations okay? Or what do they think about these items being shown and collected by European, white, Eurocentric institutions? Many people, unfortunately, from all backgrounds, don't feel comfortable in museums because museums have this... Right. You know, kind of facade of elitism, or a lot do, and that's kind of something that museums have been working to change a lot, and is going to take a long time. And now being connected virtually, I think, is really kind of a marker in that shift of accessibility. But I'm really curious as to, you know, also, you know, that, I mean, that's your job. You're a Native curator, so you have to have these objects to, you know, for to have a job, first of all. and also you know, you have that responsibility, but I'm wondering how I mean, that's really generalizing how Native populations feel about having their objects in museums. And I don't even know if that's a question you could answer, but comment on
that. Yeah, I mean, it's pretty much not a question I can answer because every Native person feels differently and every tribe has, you know, maybe a different relationship with local museums. Maybe they have their own tribal museum. So I will say that museums aren't automatically the bad guy, but they were the bad guy in previous generations. When we're looking to the early foundations of museums, they're places of colonial plunder. And as a result, they're, many museums were sites of like horrific trauma for people seeing these objects that were literally stolen. So I feel very lucky that that is not the case for the BMA. You know, I look to places like natural history museums. Many of them are working very hard to, you know, reinvent themselves or create a place that's more inclusive. But I've experienced traumatic times when I'm visiting natural history museums and go from the dinosaur room to the people room. And it's my culture, but just my culture alone. So I think that it has to do with context, and it has to do with the sorts of stories that are told. Is that a story that I should be telling, that a museum should be telling? Is that a story that anybody can hear? I mean, within Native cultures, you know, there are certain stories that they're specific to a tribe, and even within that tribe, only a few people are supposed to hear it. So we have to acknowledge that, you know, there's a lot of history to unpack. And we need to figure out a way to make everybody feel like they're invited at the museum. And we're working really hard at the BMA to navigate those waters and make it feel like a second home to people or an inclusive space where they can see their history and learn about histories that they never knew about.
I think it's a good segue into your exhibition. If you could talk about your first big exhibition.
My first big exhibition at the BMA. So it's called Stripes and Stars, Reclaiming Lakota Independence. And essentially, my story with this exhibition begins in our storage facility. I was walking through the aisles, and I came across this child's bonnet that was fully beaded with huge American flags on both sides. And I thought to myself, I looked at the tag, I saw it was Lakota, I saw it was from around the 1890s, and I asked myself, why would a Lakota person in this horribly traumatic time period, after a series of massacres and being forced onto the reservation, why would they put the emblem of their oppressor on this child's bonnet? So I started digging into the history, becoming more familiar with, you know, the Lakota people's experience with the U.S. government, and really the historical story begins in 1876. At the centennial anniversary of our nation's founding. During that year, the Battle of Little Bighorn took place, and the Lakota handedly defeated the American forces led by George Custer. And that was a huge blow to the American psyche. And as a result, white America started really forcing Natives to live on the reservation, to give up their former ways of life, and they started stamping out Native culture. And so in the 1880s, there was a law passed called the Code of Indian Offenses, and that formally outlawed the Lakota language, really, really critical ceremonies like the sun dance that were foundational to Lakota identity. And as I'm unpacking this complicated history, I start to realize that many of these objects were made for children. And I think about the makers of those objects. Bead workers are women, you know, oftentimes mothers or family members. And so by beading a bonnet or a vest or a pair of pants or boots that their children were going to wear, they were marking them as American. So when those kids were walking around on the reservation, they didn't get negative attention of the white reservation agents. Hopefully, it signaled their future and the sort of world that they were entering into. They were no longer just Lakota. They were Lakota American. And then also with this story, I found a lot of works that related to the 4th of July. There were ledger drawings that depicted 4th of July parades or photographs of the readings of the Declaration of Independence, where a white reservation agent is at the center of a bunch of Lakota people listening. And I'm like, what is going on with this? And I recognize that the timing of the 4th of July neatly overlaps with the time that the Sundance ceremony typically took place. And wow. So the Lakota people recognized that and said, hey, let's gather. Let's have our parades. Let's do giveaways. Let's do puberty rights ceremonies. And as long as we display a bunch of flags, you know, do some patriotic activities like reading the Declaration of Independence, as long as we do those things, we can get away with these cultural activities that are normally banned. So there's this incredible sort of stroke of genius of these Lakota people who were doing things that were illegal right under the noses of white reservation agents. If you put yourself in the mind of that reservation agent, you see all these flags around, you think, wow, I have succeeded. These people are excited to be Americans when really they are figuring out ways to have their own cultural practices in spite of, you know, the odds being radically stacked against them. So those are the main themes that are discussed in the show.
That's really amazing. It reminds me of the kind of the Mexica in the 16th century, you know, when the Spanish missionaries were coming in and colonizing, you know, Mexico, they were able to integrate their two religious ceremonies and practices right under their nose. And that's kind of the beautiful hybrid culture that is Mexico now.
Yeah.
I don't think
that's a lot of indigenous, you know, a lot of indigenous cultures had to figure out ways to look like they were embracing white culture. Or, you know, the dominant culture, when really they were still holding on to their own practice.
With the visitors that you've had, what has the reaction been like?
It's really interesting. My another curator in my department called me the other day and is like, my neighbor saw your show and said it changed her life. I'm like, wow, really? what did she change? And my colleague said she dyed her hair that night. Like, oh, okay, well, I'm glad she felt empowered to dye her hair. So I love that little anecdote. I think it has certainly made an impact on individuals. And then in terms of visibility, the Wall Street Journal covered the show in a larger piece about our 2020 Vision Initiative that is highlighting women artists this entire year with our exhibition programming. So there have been those moments. I've also given talks, you know, in the Johns Hopkins Public Health Center. I did a talk that discussed how Native art, particularly these works by Lakota artists, ensured their survival. It's sort of like code switching in a way. They were speaking to one audience, one message, and then speaking to their fellow tribesmen in a totally different message. So had some press and some attention on this show, and I'm so grateful for all of it.
I love that. Someone dying their hair after they see a show. I think that's...
Yeah. I'm like, was it red, white, and blue?
Yeah, right? I know. I want to know what color it was.
Yeah.
But you did some really interesting things in the show to bring contemporary Lakota members to really engage with the show and kind of enrich the your presentation of it, especially since you're not Lakota. There's a certain distance that you have from the material. And can you talk about some of the things you did?
Yeah. So I was so lucky to already know this amazing performance artist who is Lakota named Sheldon Raymore. And I met him in New York. We were collaborating on a different project. And when I came down to Baltimore and was thinking through what sort of audio tour stops I wanted to put together, he immediately popped to mind since he's an artist, he's a bead worker, he does quill working, and has such a profound connection to the Lakota community. So he saw all the objects. I shared, you know, multiple pictures with him, and he immediately drew connections that I didn't see. Like, he saw some children's boots and thought of Powwow Dance, a boots and hats special where kids wear, you know, cowboy hats and cowboy boots and compete. And that's something that I didn't think of. And he also highlighted different modes of making from a perspective of a maker himself. He was able to speak to the difficulty of quill working, which is when you apply porcupine quills to a flat surface. And that is a very involved process that eventually gave way to beadwork, because beadwork is easier, quite frankly. It's easier and it can be manipulated more and into different directions. So he brought that level of insight and also invited another Lakota member to create original music for the audio stops, which was really amazing. So it was great to collaborate with him, and it was great to have the museum support to do that. I think since, you know, we're in the time of COVID, people are, it's easier to reach out to people digitally. So we were able to have meetings together and kind of brainstorm. And so it was a really rich experience, and I appreciated his perspective.
So currently, as you said, it's the only gallery that's open in the museum. And so it's really kind of the Baltimore Museum of Indigenous Art right now, and the gift shop, which I think is a wonderful, you know, it's a great achievement early on in your career. And you told me that kind of one of the hallmark pieces when you first see the show is a really interesting object that has to do with a horse. Can you tell us about that and installing that? And
so it's a fully beaded horse mask, which means it covers the horse's entire head. There's little holes for its ears and eyes. And it would have been worn by a horse during a 4th of July parade. It's covered in American flags. And some of the American flags look backwards. And I was like, why would that be the case? And I walked around to the other side, and they're the correct orientation that way. And I realized when the horse moves, this is the way the flag would fly as it walked forward. So that was kind of an interesting moment that it only occurred to me when I saw it installed in space. And one thing I love about the installation is that the mask is actually at horse height. So I was doing research and how many hands tall horses would have been at the time, you know, at the turn of the century. And so we installed it with that in mind, and it's really powerful to see it, you know, right in your face instead of on a wall. It's in the center of the gallery. You can see it on all four sides and just think about the life that it had and the horse that might have worn it at some time.
I can see you doing that. I can see you with your hands and measuring that, really getting into it. It's probably cool for educators if they're able to take, you know, kids or people around the show.
It's certainly digitally. We don't have many school tours right now, but we are offering a lot of digital programs that are totally new, which is great.
I don't know anything about the indigenous population of Baltimore and their relationship with the museum, and I'm wondering if you could talk about that. The challenges of creating that link and repairing the link, and how that's also part of your job.
Yeah. So I come from the West Coast. I grew up in California and, you know, went to undergrad at Stanford with a huge Native population from all over. You know, it's one of the biggest powwows in the U.S. And so when I moved to the East Coast, I wasn't really prepared for how different things are out here for Native people. They had hundreds of years more exposure to white culture, and different experiences where they were pushed out of their homelands and, you know, ended up in the plains when they didn't originally live there. So the history of Natives in Baltimore is quite involved. There are two major tribes that are local to this region, the Piscataway, who are still around today, and the Susquehannock, who are not. So essentially, this one cool thing that a historian studying at Hopkins discovered, Emma Bilski, she found a treaty from the 1600s in which the Susquehannock ceded the land to the colonists here, which is really interesting and was just very trippy to read that. But I think there's quite a bit of you know, conversations happening at Hopkins right now through the Public Health Center about what it means to be Indigenous here, how we can support Indigenous people's, you know, livelihood and wellness. And also it raises questions of like land acknowledgement. So the museum, I recently assumed this position during COVID. I think I was officially instated as a curator in October. So I'm pretty new to the field, and I'm keen to do outreach and work on a land acknowledgement with the committee in a really thoughtful way. So that's what's in the future. COVID makes everything so challenging, though. These are people I would love to meet in person, and rather than do like some sad phone call. So we're figuring out what the best approach is for this time, and also really mindful that Native people have bigger things going on in their lives right now than art. You know, COVID has disproportionately affected Native people and Native lives, and is really jeopardizing many people's lives in ways that we could have just never predicted prior to COVID. So I also am respectful of that fact and don't want to steal attention from that really important situation. So it's kind of a juggling act. We're figuring out different ways to reach out to people and where to start, and also be respectful that people have other things going on in their lives right now. And hopefully once COVID is behind us, I want to have in-person meetings. I want to, you know, really go to powwows again. We have a powwow in Baltimore that's definitely been canceled, which is the right call, but I miss seeing people participating in Native culture. So I'm excited for COVID to be over for that and many other reasons.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, the community aspect is something that we're all missing. I miss going to openings. I miss going to parties. I miss going to museums and feeling safe in a museum. That's another thing. But I mean, definitely during COVID, it was art is a luxury. You know, health comes first. But art is essential, too, is another thing. I remember when they reopened Texas. Yeah. Which they did early because it's Texas. One of the things that was allowed to reopen at capacity was, or at a certain capacity, was museums. And I thought that was really interesting. So now we're going to segue into the lightning round. These are short questions I haven't given you. But your husband did appear on episode 3 of the podcast. So you all are no strangers. That's Abraham Berkson. He's the creative director and co-founder of Odyssey Works. This is the shameless plug for episode 3 of season 1. So the first question is, early bird or night owl?
Can I say neither?
Well, yeah, with the new baby, you are neither. Yeah.
Yeah, I guess, probably night owl. Let's be realistic. I wish I were an early bird, but it's just not in my nature.
Same. Coffee or tea?
Definitely coffee. I used to be a hardcore mate tea drinker, but I transitioned to coffee after having a kid and just needing a little extra kick of caffeine every day.
I love that that's what it took. It took having a child to just switch over to coffee.
Yep.
Talking or texting?
The millennial in me is like texting. But it's nice to have a phone conversation every once in a while. So I'll say texting with a couple of talking, you know, times sprinkled in.
Fair enough. Facebook or Instagram?
Neither. That's like showing the sort of like square in me, but Facebook, I don't have Instagram at all because I just don't need another social media in my life. And Facebook is, there's nothing ever happening on there. Yeah. You know, I follow different arts organizations, and that's the only reason I keep Facebook at all, pretty much.
What's the last book you read?
Rebecca Roanhorse's Black Sun was absolutely amazing. It's like this sort of futuristic fantasy based in an indigenous perspective instead of like the European perspective. So I loved that. I'm sort of like outing myself as a little bit of a nerd by reading fantasy, but you know, Black Sun changed my tune about fantasy. I'm like all about the genre now.
That's cool. That's really cool. What's your first memory in a museum?
Ooh, that's a great question. I don't know that I have a super early one. I want to say like a natural history museum as a kid, seeing the dinosaurs, but I'm not sure if that actually happened or if that's just the idea of
That's the nature of memories, yeah. Or maybe even one that's like, you know, the most formidable.
I would say the most formative experience I had in the museum was actually provided to me with the help of my husband. He does long, performances for audiences of one. And a piece of that, of my performance, was a group of 30 or so of us gathered at the DM Museum, and we spent an hour just looking at three works of art. We didn't learn anything about them, and we just stood with them. And apparently, as we were spending 20 minutes with our second work of art, one guard asked another, "What is this group doing?" And the other guard said, "I think they're looking at the art." And that was just such a revelation that people would be spending time looking at a single work of art. So I would say that that's my favorite museum experience, even though it's definitely not my first.
What do you collect?
Personally, I collect audiobooks. I'm a big audiobook listener. I've listened to 42 since lockdown. Some of those are really short. Yeah, I mean, it's crazy. I'm a huge audiobook person. So I'd say that's my biggest thing I collect. And then random baby ephemera, because we have a child who, loves his bouncy chair until all of a sudden that is completely obsolete and he won't sit still. So we're just kind of acquiring more and more baby stuff. Yeah, so I'd say those are my two main things I collect.
If you weren't caring for the collections at the BMA, what would you be doing?
Well, when I'm not at the museum, I also teach graphic design at Maryland Institute College of Art. So I might be spending more time there, but it's hard to imagine. I mean, so much of my time in Baltimore has been spent at the museum. I pretty much started working there like within maybe 3 months of moving here. So it's hard to imagine exactly what I would be doing if not at this museum. Maybe it'd be a different museum. Maybe I would lean more into teaching, I think. Kind of any of the above would be possibilities.
If you could own one work of art, what would it be?
I think one of Jeffrey Gibson's Everlast beaded punching bags. Those are
they're incredible.
Really are. Yeah. Mixed media works. And just the technical mastery he has of beading is totally breathtaking. So I would say he's probably at the top of the list, but I'm sure I would have a different answer tomorrow.
Right. What's the best piece of advice you could give someone who wants to support Native art or become involved in, working with Native artists or who has interest in that, developing that?
I think that a good place to start is always books. You know, spend time with Native art books and figure out different things that interest you and sort of reverse engineer from that. If you are super interested in this one style of plains beadwork, figure out what museums have the best collections of that. Maybe join a museum membership group that's dedicated to that. Figure out ways that you can volunteer and would you be able to be a docent of this specific material? And reach out. You know, a lot of times museums have emails on their website that you can reach out just to different departments. And last but not least, I think apply to jobs. The museum field is pretty tight-knit and small. And so a lot of times if you can get one position, you can kind of move to other positions, get to know the field, figure out where you want to be. So volunteering and just applying to jobs is also a great place to start.
How do you think museums can be more thoughtful about presenting their Native material?
Invite Native people to the table. Ideally pay them and or hire them full time. So I think that a lot of museums have advisory boards that are volunteer based, which is awesome. I love that. I think it's even better when a person is actually a member of the institution and understands the different sort of bureaucratic elements that go into displaying works this way. They understand how to manage, fulfilling donor requirements. Maybe some works always have to be on view. And if you're outside of the institution, you might not recognize that there are a lot of rules to what you display. So I think that the biggest things museums can do is invite Native voices to participate in, developing the collection or thinking about how to display it.
Yeah, and realize that that's an important part of your community.
Yeah, it's really an essential first step.
Is there any advice you'd give to Native artists who are working today who maybe they don't want to be collected in museums or maybe they do want to be collected in museums?
Yeah, it's tricky. I mean, I think it depends so much on the person's, you know, cultural background, if they're in community or if they're working alone. So my advice to, and also that doesn't even point to like the medium. You know, so someone working in basketry would really benefit from learning from, you know, elderly basket weavers who maybe remember weaving styles that aren't, you know, as utilized today. So I think it depends on the artist and what their objectives are. And yeah,
it's a complicated history when you talk about museums as places of trauma for Native people, and it still is, and probably forever will be, depending on, you know, I mean, hopefully once they all have Native curators who are more thoughtful about what they're presenting, because I know that we've been to shows at big museums where there has been material that's presented and there's even things on view that it's inappropriate. It's because they're approaching it. Yeah, and it's because they're approaching it as...
You can feel that from the object.
Yeah.
So I think there are a lot of times, you know, every once in a while I'll be like, oh my God, X museum put Y thing on view. How did they do that? And probably it's because they didn't ask a Native person, should this thing be on view? So I think that just having Native stakeholders is of paramount importance.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And I'm glad to see that that's starting to happen. And that you are holding that torch in Baltimore and will continue to do that. My final question I ask everyone is that there's no crystal ball, but if I give you a magic wand, what's your wish for the art world?
That it continues to help generate empathy. I think empathy is something we are sorely lacking in this political climate and, you know, just 2020 in general. And I think art is uniquely positioned to help people feel empathy, help people understand what it's like to be of a different culture from a different time, and just having a different perspective. So my wish for the art world is to figure out a way to make those moments happen, even amidst COVID.
I couldn't agree more. And I love that. It's, you know, that's the power of art and museums that hold collections of multiple cultures, you know, being able to show that we're all, you know, all humans, all cultures can achieve and celebrate beautiful things and make incredible things. And it shows us that we're all one.
I feel really privileged to work at the Baltimore Museum of Art, which has such a strong commitment to social equity and inviting different perspectives. And we have just such a great curatorial team that collaborates across many different disciplines. So I feel like our institution can serve as a role model to other institutions that want to embrace social equity movements.
Baltimore is a very diverse city too.
We're a majority minority city. So I think that we're kind of the future of America in a lot of ways. So hopefully the BMA can serve as a model to what an American museum might look like in the future.
I love that. Well, thank you so much. This has been so fun.
Well, thanks for chatting with me.
Yeah, no.
So generously to be on the program.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. A lot of fun. Thanks again for listening to this episode of Artroverted. Remember, when it comes to art, it doesn't matter if you're introverted or extroverted, because you can always be artroverted. Thanks again for listening. We'll see you soon.